I will call this meeting of the Children and Families Committee to order. Thanks for being here, everyone. It is diaper day today. But first, we need to move a motion on the minutes. Chair Katisa Watoon, I think.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the minutes. March 12th minutes.
Thank you, Chair Katisa Watoon. Chair Katisa Watoon moves the March 12th minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all of those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Chair Katisa Watoon.
Mr. Chair, we have Representative Chair Pinto with us. Welcome back to the committee, Chair Pinto. I would move House File 2135 to be before the committee, or to be laid over for hostile inclusion.
Chair Pinto, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be back in the Children and Families Committee. A little bittersweet. I have been missing, I don't know if you've been missing me, but I've been missing you. So really important work that you do in this committee, and so grateful to be back before you. House File 2135 is a bill that, proposal that actually advanced out of our committee last year, I think, and had I think, a quite broad support. I will note that there is a DE3, which kind of tightens the bill in many respects, and so I might, if I may, request that we get the bill, get the DE3 added on, and we can talk about what's in it
further. Sounds like a plan. Chair Katisa Watoon.
Mr. Chair, I would move the DE3.
Chair Katisa Watoon moves the DE3. I think we'll just adopt it and talk about the bill unless there is any objection. All right. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and the DE3 is adopted. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So what the bill as amended does is to commission a fiscal analysis of our child welfare system. This is a system that is extremely complicated in many ways, but that includes its finances. And in particular, there are a number of funding streams that there's reason to believe that we are not taking full advantage of. We certainly want to make sure to do so when it comes to the welfare of kids in our state. So the DE3, it's a nice tightening from the original language in terms of directing DCYF to contract with a consultant to conduct the fiscal analysis that I just described. There's some requirements that are listed towards the bottom of page one as to what needs to be done in that analysis, and on the top of page two, a report that is given to us, and you'll note in the middle of page two, maximizing our receipt and use of funding streams and federal resources, and then making any proposals to us for any changes that are necessary. So straightforward, and I think has some real advantages. There's at least one and perhaps two testifiers. I can't quite remember, I'll admit, Mr. Chair, but folks will help me out with that, I'm sure.
Yeah, go ahead and come on up and introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tracy Laliberty, and I am from the School of Social Work at the University of Minnesota, and I run a research and training center for child welfare. Very happy to be here today. In my assessment, the activities required in HF 2135, it positions the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, county and tribal child welfare agencies, and the legislature to have critically important data available for engagement and discussions about the future of Minnesota's child welfare system. Before we get to what we don't know, I thought we would talk a little bit about what we do know. We know that in Minnesota, we are one of two states with the lowest state contribution for child welfare services in the country. Minnesota relies heavily on our county and tribal partners to carry the majority of the financial burden for our child protection system through property tax dollars and/or other tribal funds. As compared to many other states, Minnesota as a state invests the lower amount in the public child welfare system.
Let me pull a little closer to you.
Oh, okay. Counties and tribes must manage and mix local, state, and federal funding sources. In addition, because of the reliance on local funding, our child welfare system can be significantly under-resourced, particularly in the areas with highest need. As we continue to operate in this context, We need to better understand the financial landscape in order to better plan for funding that is necessary for services for children and families and supporting the work of counties and tribes. We also know that Minnesota shares a common challenge with other states in that we have made numerous attempts at system reform over the years. We know that child welfare systems are complex and involve a variety of professionals, including social workers, judges, attorneys, law enforcement, mental and behavioral health practitioners, and many more. Nationally and in Minnesota, we have seen that change or reform is expensive, taxing on the workforce, and most problematic, difficult to sustain. I suggest to you that one reason for this is what we do not know. In Minnesota, we do not know the full composition and the gaps in the financial foundation of the Minnesota Child Welfare Services. When reform efforts are implemented, finances are examined in the context of that one specific change. We do not ever get the full scope of the financial landscape. In an effort of that funding, an aspect is that if that funding is eliminated or repurposed, the reform slowly drifts away. This bill moves Minnesota into a position of understanding its fiscal health, risks, and opportunities. We will be able to understand what funding is being accessed, maximized, and what funding is being left untapped. These untapped dollars stand to offer critically needed services and resources across Minnesota. I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge our current federal landscape. We do not know what lies ahead in terms of federal funding for child welfare services. While child welfare has not yet experienced direct cuts in the same way that other social services have, conducting an analysis like this allows us to get the scope of what is currently available so that if funding streams are curtailed, we're aware of other potential sources that could be accessed. Child welfare funding is one of the most complicated funding streams in human services. Critical to this bill is having external and independent analysis into how Minnesota is investing and spending its funds in the child welfare system. The report produced as a result of this bill will provide essential transparency. In addition to a comprehensive financial analysis, this bill gives Minnesota an opportunity to gain greater understanding of child welfare programs, practices, and services. While it is doubtful that Minnesota would ever have a traditional practice model due to its organization of state oversight and county administration, a common practice framework is likely and would advantage children, families, and communities across the state. One final thought on this bill. Many constituent groups and individuals have come together to help draft and support this effort, including the state, counties, Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and community advocates and service providers. This is needed.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if there is another. That may be just the only. I think that's the only testifier, so nobody further from me, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Lalaberty. Any other members of the public willing to testify on House File 2135? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony and go to member questions. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto, for bringing this bill forward. I see that in the delete all amendment that we just accepted, it still has a blank appropriation. Do we know what the cost of this kind of a study is going to take?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Representative Olson. Great question. I think that a fiscal note has been, the D3 was just finalized. I'm not sure Mr. Berg may be able to comment on that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Berg.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Berg may recall, I don't know if he would have this handy, but there was an amount, I think this is similar to what we attempted to pass, what passed out of the House last session, and so there may give us order of magnitude sense. Obviously, we want to get the fiscal note back, and I can't quite remember what ended up, what we ended up doing last year, but that may be helpful as well, Representative Olson.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the answer. One thing, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't make a comment on this aspect of it's a little bit sad that in Minnesota's government we can't seem to get major changes done unless we do a report or an analysis or some kind of a task force that we create. It kind of seems like that's the current culture of our state government. And sometimes these reports are exceedingly expensive, and sometimes these reports come up with answers that we already knew were the answer, but it finally just gives us the ammunition to do it. I mean, we just spent a ton of money in transportation seeing a report that we all knew that North Star has terrible ridership, and it took a report to decide that the transportation department has now said, hey, maybe we should look into it. I was in the tax committee last year, and we received a report from the department that said something could cost between $2 and $20 million to do. And I said, I could stand at a dartboard and I could throw a dart and I could be closer than $2 to $20 million. That's a pretty wide spread. And so I just hope that as we're going through this, and I think you've done some really good work here, Representative Pinto, so I don't know if your analysis will fall through those kind of cracks that we're looking at here of a report that's going to identify something that we already know of, or just give us more ammunition to do something that we already knew we should have done. Because I think in that case, it is a waste of taxpayer dollars to just provide yourself with a, in their instance, it was a 13-page report that cost somewhere near $50,000 to do and tell us exactly nothing. I don't think that yours is designed that way, but I think it would be remiss if I didn't make a comment that I think Minnesota government, I wish we could get away from the need to do that and just get the work done, get the stakeholders involved and then make it happen. But obviously, like, this is a huge thing. So I'm not thinking that one person alone can make it happen. I just had to bring that comment to the floor and say that whereas sometimes these reports and analysis are necessary, sometimes they are not necessary. This one may be necessary.
Thank you, Representative Olson. And Chair Katizabatun just pointed out $250,000, I think, was appropriated for it the last go-around.
Sounds right, Mr. Chair, from last time.
Chair Pinto, any comment on
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that amount sounds right, and I certainly will defer to whatever Mr. Berg tells us. Oh, looks like Mr. Berg may have something else, Mr. Chair.
Strings into action. Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair, I just looked up last year's. The net cost was $170,000. It was $250,000 appropriation. Then there's FFP on it from the federal match. Get to a net cost of $170,000.
And Mr. Berg, would that apply to what we're talking about right here?
It's very similar language. A year has passed.
Chair Katizabatun.
Mr. Berg, what has changed at the federal level that might complicate things here?
Chair does not recognize Mr. Berg.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I promise I will not. I won't go there on this comment, Mr. Chair. I'll get back to Representative Olson's comment, Mr. Chair, if I can. But I think what you say is very well taken, Representative Olson, and I think we can all identify. I guess I'm thinking especially about that category of report that is just done because we know what we want to do, and we either need an excuse to do it, or maybe just we don't yet have the political will, so at least we have a report now. I do think this is a different situation, though. I'm looking at some information that actually, I guess it's in the letter from MAXA and the Association of Minnesota Counties in the packet, that Minnesota counties are responsible for more than 40% of the funding in the child welfare area. The national average is about 10%. So our counties, actually, that we all work with and our county property taxpayers are taking on four times the level of proportional share. And these federal laws are complicated. It's also in the same letter, Family First Prevention Services Act, passed 6 years ago. And there's funding streams in there that we're just not taking advantage of yet. And I think it's not the sort of thing that sort of we as legislators or sort of somebody can do on the side. You sort of need somebody, sadly, just the structure we have, to kind of dive into it and say, okay, if we structure things this way and this way and this way, we can actually decrease that county share, increase the funding. So I think you make a good point in general. I do feel like this may be one of those, an example of a board that actually may be beneficial. So.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Sensomura.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto, for this bill. I think I have a question, and maybe this is just as a new member of the committee, but so from what I'm understanding you saying, you're talking about different funding streams, county, state, and federal, and it sounds like in Minnesota we are unique in that our county is paying more, our state contribution is less, and then this bill would help us understand if there is federal funding that's being left on the table. I think my question is, is it that the state, we think that the state will end up needing to pay more? Is it that we think that there's federal money out there that we are not getting. I guess I'm just trying to kind of reconcile. The state already pays a very low amount, given the federal climate. Like, how would we actually be finding more federal money, or is it just kind of the conclusion that maybe the state needs to pay more? Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Representative Sensenmura. So first, I think, and I'll provide a bit of a sense and then turn to my expert to provide more detail here. I think we want to be careful about what we know is that counties are paying more than four times as much proportionally as in other states. I think we want to be careful about immediately drawing the conclusion then that must mean state. It may be that you know, we're doing more in individual counties. That's statistics that I have and want to get comment from Dr. Laliberti on that. What I will note is just in the bill, you'll see lines 1.8 and 1.9 and on the back as well, that it references child welfare funding streams and federal resources. And it kind of deliberately, it's not just necessarily federal resources. There may be other sources of funds available. The idea is just that we want to make sure that we're using whatever sources there are. Most likely that's federal funds, but as I understand it, it could be others as well, and we don't know exactly the conclusion we can draw. But Dr. Laliberti may have more to add, Mr. Chair. I can turn to Dr. Laliberti, if that's okay, Mr. Chair, to add a little more.
Ms. Laliberti.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you summarized it very well. I do think that what this will allow for us to do is to look at that federal landscape and to know the places that we are not maximizing the dollars. And then as things are shifting, because we're always checking it out every single day, we are going to know if we need to shift away from something that was cut. Is there another place for us to seek that same kind of funding or that same level of funding? And that really is what the analysis, the deeper analysis, is designed to do.
Representative Sensenmura? Okay. Any other member questions? So on this, I think it's particularly wise for us to utilize as much federal funding as we possibly can. There is one comment I've gotten when I've talked about this bill with other members is, well, isn't this the department's job already? I don't know if you have a comment or the department can tell us what they're doing, but that has come up in conversations I've had. Ms. Laliberti.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is the department's responsibility in some regard because they have oversight, and each county is also doing its own work to be able to leverage the dollars and to be able to create programs based on what it is that the community needs, but also what they can support and fund. It's very difficult for the state to be able to do all of that and to be able to do that in an objective way, or to not be part of it, because they're just instrumental in being able to execute this. So really having an outside view that helps transparency so that we all have an opportunity to look at what the possibilities are, I think is really important in this situation. Minnesota's funding with the high county contribution has existed for a really long time. That is our history, and that is part of the county autonomy and the county's ability to be able to tailor things to its own community. But when you have counties that have very low property tax base, the kids and families who are facing incredibly complex situations do not have access to the same services as perhaps another county. And this is designed to be able to look at all of the available pockets so that across the state, we're able to bring in more resource to increase those services to kids and families.
Thank you, Ms. Laliberti. Representative Pinto.
Thank you. I'll just have a final comment. I'll just note this, Mr. Chair. Ours is one of only a few systems around the country. Our child welfare system is state supervised but county administered. So if ours was a system that was entirely state run, again, as most states are, I think that what you say would be, that concern would make particular sense, you know, because like, hey, this is the department's job and they're the ones doing it. But most of this work is actually being done at the county level. certainly good for the state to do all it can to help the counties get federal dollars, but it does start getting a little attenuated, a little more stretched, if that makes sense. So part of it is it's the complexity of the system we have, where primarily it's each of our counties' job to do this, and they're not going to be in the position to maximize federal resources, you know, whatever our individual counties are to do that. The other thing I'll just note is the range of supporters here, for those who may not be as familiar with the child welfare space, it is striking to have supporters from sort of across the spectrum of views on child welfare issues all saying this is something that is really needed. So that's a powerful statement too. Thank you. And that could be the end of it, Mr. Chair, if you whoever works.
But I have a couple more comments.
Yeah, okay.
So brace yourself.
Okay. All set.
All right. So maximizing federal dollars is something I think is really important. I had a great meeting in my office where we dug into a lot of the aspects of your original bill. I was happy to hear that many of the concerns I shared were also shared by the author, and your DE does improve it immensely, because one aversion I have as a legislator of a couple years now is we have so many task force, we have so many working groups, and it's just the endless admiring of the problem. So I was happy to see that we're not going to go through the effort of doing a whole nother task force just for this specific purpose. And my hope is it's like we want public input on as much things as possible. That's what the committee system is for. But when you're doing a fiscal analysis, I think that's a more of a dollars and cents issue rather than soliciting community input. So I think the DE3 did move the bill in the right direction, and I wanted to make note of that. I think if we're going to incorporate this into our greater bill, that was definitely necessary. But before I give it to you for closing comments, if you want them, just any other member questions? Or Representative Pinto, anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I had the chance to make them, and I'll just thank you for the hearing and Madam Chair as well and the committee members. I think this would be a very, if you can, I know it would be a tight budget situation, but I think this could be a really big payoff in the long run for the kids in our state. And thank you so much for the time.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. And with that, House File 2135 is laid over for possible inclusion in a later omnibus bill. Vice Chair Hansen, officially. With House File 776. Go ahead and get after it. Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I would move that House File 776 be moved for possible inclusion in our omnibus package. And I appreciate the time and the hearing today. So good afternoon, members. House File 776 is a bill to make sure that we can continue to fund the FAME program. Financial security is a foundation for opportunity, the opportunity to buy a home, further an education, or start a business. And the Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota, or FAME program, helps Minnesotans turn those goals into a reality. House File 776 ensures that FAME can continue its critical work by maintaining funding at its current levels by adding $1.5 million to the base in each fiscal year 26 and 27. FAME helps Minnesotans save money for key investments that create long-term financial stability. The program provides financial literacy training and matching funds to help participants build a more secure future. And this is not a handout, members. This is an extended hand up to lift others when they need it. FAME empowers people to take control of their financial futures by fostering both independence and self-sufficiency. This program has always had broad bipartisan support because it delivers real results for Minnesota families, individuals, and communities across the state. And so without continuing this investment, many families could lose access to what has been a proven path out of poverty toward financial stability, security, and independence. And with that, I will ask you to please hear the stories of my testifiers here who are living proof that FAME works and is worth our investment to make sure that more people can achieve financial independence and stability right here in Minnesota. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Chair West and Chair Katiza Watun and members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. My name is David Snyder, and I'm the Director of Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota, the FAME program, based at West Central Minnesota Communities Action in Elbow Lake. I'm testifying today in support of House File 776. FAME is an asset-building program that supports low-income working Minnesotans across the state to save up, gain financial education and coaching, and then have their savings up to $4,000 tripled after 2 years in order to purchase a home, launch a small business, buy a car, establish an emergency fund, a college savings plan for a dependent, or for their own college tuition. Our network of coaches at partner organizations work with clients on financial education, credit repair, budgeting, and they provide asset-specific education, like homeownership pre-purchase counseling, as the clients save and prepare to purchase their asset. The savings match provides the incentive to keep someone in the program, learning, acquiring financial skills and discipline, and letting those skills sink in and take root. And those skills, in turn, allow the person a good chance to become a sustainable owner of the asset. One of our external evaluations from a few years ago bears this out, showing that FAME graduate homeowners and small business owners had a significantly higher rate of home and business retention, even after a number of years. The one-time funding boost we received in the last biennium allowed us to increase the number of FAME accounts from 65 with just base funding to around 200 accounts, accounting for a higher maximum possible match. And that was raised from $8,000 to $12,000 maximum match if the participant saves the maximum $4,000 in 2 years. That boost also allowed us to expand the FAME network by initiating partnerships with 8 new agencies that reach new geographical and cultural communities, like the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, Seeds of Justice in Worthington, and Minnesota 8, serving the Asian American community in the Twin Cities. It's truly an honor to be part of this critical investment in working families in every corner of the state, and I'm grateful to the legislature for its past support of FAME and for your consideration of House File 776. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other testifiers who'd like to, from the public, who would like to speak on the bill? Thank you for joining us. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, everybody. FAME programs change and saves lives because that's what it did for my family. My name is Mayra Espitia. I'm from Mexico. I have been a resident of Minnesota for almost 7 years. I'm a single mom. I suffered domestic violence. I'm a survivor. I have 3 children. My life has not been easy. I was in a shelter. I had nothing. This is how my history in the United States begins. Through Casa Esperanza and NIRA, I learned about a FAME program. FAME program is a blessing that marked the beginning of many wonderful things in my life. Things I never imagined would have, like my house that I got in February 10, 2023, my safe place for my family and me. After getting my house, many blessings come into our lives. I found a good job. My children started college. My daughter is studying international business in London. And my son is studying dual degrees in accounting and gastronomy. They are twins. And the smallest is in high school. I'm studying cosmetology in a school, St. Paul College. I started my own business for organic hair treatment. And also, I volunteer and prepare and prosper tax services to help my community and give back a little of what I receive. For this reason and many more, I testify the FAME program changes and saves lives. I feel grateful and blessed for this program, and I hope it continues to exist and help to help families like mine. FAME programs With FAPE programs, I get a safe place for my family and better life. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any other member of the public who would like to testify on House File 776? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony and go to member questions. Any member questions? Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chairs, and thank you, Representative Hansen. So I'm a huge supporter of the FAME program, and I have permission to share this story of a constituent of mine. So she is a woman with autism. She works as a early childhood special education paraprofessional with others, with little ones with autism in our Rochester Public Schools. And she also works as a CNA with our elders on the weekends and in the summer when she's not at our school district. And she is a phenomenal person. But as you can about imagine, in a caregiving field with the wages that she makes, home ownership was very difficult for her to achieve. And so several years ago now, she participated in the FAME program, got the counseling from our local CAP that did some support, Three Rivers, which is great in our community, learned how to save and budget and had a FAME account and spent a couple of years really building that account up. Mm-hmm. And she owns a home now in our community that she has now had for, oh gosh, probably quite a while, I guess. I can't do math today. But it has been so amazing to see her be able to be on that journey and step into home ownership. And in our community, home prices have really shot up pretty dramatically recently. And because she has owned that home for some time, she has the security of knowing that she will be housed. And she's able to continue to do the great work that she does with our littlest learners in Rochester and not feel like she has to switch jobs because she can't afford to live in our community. And so just thank you for the work that you all do, and thank you for sharing your story. I think it's just so powerful when we give people the financial tools to be self-sufficient what they can achieve.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, kind of want to echo what Representative Hicks said. I've long been a fan of FAME for those exact reasons. And I want to actually direct folks' attention to the handout because I think there's sort of the side of it that you hear the individual stories like we've heard today. But in particular, I just want to point out, it says through 2024, over 3,300 assets have been acquired, and 30% of that is home purchases. Mm-hmm. And for those of us who can do the math, that means over 1,000 homes purchased. That's over 1,000 people who now have a place to live, a stable place to live. And 37% pursued post-secondary education, so more than 1,000 folks were able to go to college. And I think, you know, what this really represents is stability. Is just that sort of basic sense of stability in people's lives. And then the other side that I was thinking about as I was hearing this discussion, and I don't think I've used this phrase yet in this committee, but I often talk about pay me now or pay me later. And pay me later is always more expensive. It always has worse results. And so you sort of think of the counterfactual, the folks who were able to buy homes, how, you know, where would their lives have gone? The folks who went to college who maybe wouldn't have been able to, where would their lives have gone? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we think about how much better our state and our communities are because these folks had these opportunities. It's just really, it's one of the best deals in town, frankly. So just wanted to add that. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Nadeau.
Can you tell me, I was perusing through here, can you tell me the number of individuals through 2024 that have moved beyond the 200% FPG?
Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I was waiting for the door to shut. It's pretty noisy out in that hallway today, so I appreciate the indulgence while we just get my testifier here to give you an answer about that. He's been running this program, and he is definitely the person that if anybody here has questions about FAME, I highly suggest getting in touch with him either after this committee for more questions, but I will defer to him for now.
Right. Mr. Snyder.
Thank you. Thanks for the question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so your question is, how many of the FAME graduates have moved above 200% or less of the federal poverty line? Okay, I will need to get back to you on that. I know that people do, our graduates do, but I don't have the number exactly, so I'm happy to follow up with you. I'm sorry, I don't have the answer.
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you. This is a population that, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, this is a population that is an important population to me, and it's an important population to my community. And there's a number of programs that people who have income challenges under 200% FPG are eligible for. Can you talk to me about one of the things that I struggle with is making sure that we're doubling down on those interventions that we know are super effective, moving people to independence. Can you tell me, and maybe it's for your testifier, can you tell me how this correlates with those? And is there a way for us to identify if this intervention is actually moving people out of our public programs into independence?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. I'll defer to Dave because he'll have a better answer than me that'll sound really great.
Well, maybe. Yeah, I appreciate your question. I think, you know, on the one hand, the program, we have made sure that the income and the state match doesn't count against somebody's public benefits, because we don't want to penalize somebody for saving and getting a savings match that is going to be spent directly on an asset, and the money goes directly to closing costs or directly to the dealership. So we wanted to make sure that there wasn't an unforeseen consequence, but at the same time, our coaches work with the clients, and when you start a small business, when most of the people that are getting cars are getting better jobs and their income goes up. So I can tell you anecdotally that a large percentage of the people that go through this program come off of public benefits. And actually there are statistics in this evaluation that we had a couple years ago. This is a big hand up rather than a handout. I would be happy to follow up with you, though, with some statistics about it. I appreciate the question.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And I would just point you, Representative Doe, and the whole committee and watchers here to the second page of the handout where there is some information about some of the studies that were conducted that measured some of the things that I think you're asking about. It may not answer all of your questions, Representative Nadeau. I do think we'll probably have to follow up about the direct correlation of how certain are we that this is a guaranteed thing that will move folks off of public programs. But we know that life is always changing, and so those things are not always connected as well as we probably would like them to do. Thankfully, we had some bills before us that we can start to get some better information out of SSIS to track some of that stuff. And so we fund that and replace it, we can do a whole lot of things. I would particularly point towards the home ownership pieces of that. I think that's my favorite part about this, is making sure that we know folks are buying homes. 67 folks out of the 81 surveyed had purchased a home, and 14 were aiming to buy one in the near future. So we're looking at nearly all of the folks who were surveyed having had that opportunity. 97% of them still owned their home when this survey was done, and 2 had already sold, meaning that they were able to invest that asset into their next purchase as well. And so for the sake of committee time, I won't go over all of that, but I would point you towards those second parts there.
Representative Nadeau.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen. And I wasn't, you know, I'm not one of those people that requires a guarantee that our investments are going to, you know, produce those outcomes. But since you brought up the second, you know, the second sheet, I'll share my thoughts. Survey data is not that very, it's not evidence-based data. We deal with this all the time in so many forms of government. Most people who are receiving public services are happy to receive those public services. And that's great. And I'm happy that we can provide those. But since you brought up the home ownership, there's a, once again, we have a population that's 200% FPG. There is an enormous number of home ownership programs available through counties, through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, down payment assistance. There's programs that buy down interest rates. There's programs through the CAP agencies that help with home ownership. And so my series of questions are merely trying to identify the importance of this program. This has a base, this program has base appropriation of $326,000. Last year, the last biennium, we added almost $3 billion to this. And now this bill is to add another $1.5 billion. I'm not trying to be $1.5 million, sorry.
Thank you.
All I'm trying to do, and I am a strong supporter of what I consider to be bootstraps policies, which is and programs, which I think this is. But in this frame that we're in today, where we have to make some really hard decisions, I'd like to be able to look at this and say, you know what? This is an important program that we need to fund. So that's what I'm asking for, is to have that defense other than, yep, if we have a boatload of money, we can fund a lot of programs. We don't have a boatload of money, and I want to be able to defend this in saying that this is an important thing that is moving people out of poverty. It is a vital component to home ownership. It's a vital component to better jobs because of access to cars, and that's what I'm looking for.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and I appreciate that. Thank you, Nadeau, for your ongoing support. Welcome to the Children and Families Committee, too. This is a bill that we've talked about for many years in the past in this committee, so I'm really, really glad that we get to talk to more people about it and continue to expand this. So I think the biggest piece that I took away from what you said is that we should absolutely continue to fund this, because the failure to do so will result in a detriment, and that detriment will be that more people will have less. And we'll have less folks getting that opportunity for stability. So I appreciate the support for that. I do also want to just defend the folks who did the survey just for a second, the higher education professor in me. This was done by Gustavus Adolphus and students at U of M at the Humphrey School. I am certain that they more than likely used a utilization-focused review that ensured that the data collected on this isn't just like a Google survey, right? And understanding the long-term effects of that are really important. So shout out to the Humphrey students and those alike who helped conduct this, and I'm happy that we'll be able to get you some more information about the connected data that you're looking for as well.
Representative Perez-Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hansen. I'm so proud to co-author this alongside with you and the FAME program. My district of 65B, St. Paul, and particularly the West Side community that I was raised on, has seen the benefits since I was a child. And in the remarks of your story, Ms. Espitia, are those testimonies a continuance? Yeah. So when we talk about consistent funding from the state to support the initiatives that work, you know, and you addressed it, you hit all the points, Rep. Hansen, when you talk about the Humphrey School providing that data in the surveys, that this isn't just a, you know, put a popsicle stick in the jar and see if it works here. This takes a lot of time and decades of continued successes. When you look at the small business asset findings, as a small business owner that lives in my district and has different creative economic initiatives that we bring to the table that are competent, that are led through the directions of organizations that come from the communities and serve all communities throughout the states, I look at close to $27 million of a total estimated income revenue. That speaks a lot of what the power we can do from this committee and the Department of Children and Families that's been started to ensure that it keeps not only providing opportunity, but also brings back so that we can continue to provide opportunities when we talk about business and economic development. And then the education assets, we're talking about sometimes, and me being included, we're always a learner, okay? But there's not always spaces that
that do the outreach to get into those avenues of learning. And the opportunities that organizations like NEDA does in my district to coach folks along the way who may feel isolated or intimidated, regardless of what district you live in, what place aside, but just by having unknown or somebody say, let me guide you through this here. And then seeing the outcomes of providing home buyership or an avenue to also discuss you're talking bridging home ownership and education and then business, and they all are showing that these numbers are over a 50% accuracy rate in developing an achievement goal. That's something to note on the record here. And the expansion of this, not just being centralized, I like to, you know, highlight my district because we're in it, but when you look at the support that it gives into our tribal nations, and it was Sovereignty Day yesterday, and you know, getting all that information back to say, like, you've got Indigenous families that are coming through to say, we're staying in our communities because these are the programs that work through FAME. So I just want to say thank you, Maida, for giving your testimony. Esperanza United has a very, very strong part of my heart. And it's lovely to see the continuation that they're doing as a all Latina women founded. I know someone very special in there who was a founding board member. That is my mom, who was pregnant with me in those spaces. And I grew up to see how those women that were welcomed into that shelter are now business owners, are now doctorates of education, and are now, you know, delivering the opportunity for folks to give testimony to provide. So that's why we have these great drafted laws that make it through to get, yes, historical funding last biennium, but when they work, we have to talk about the consistency in that. And that's what I'm proud to see, that there's quite a few authors, and I, if you're not on it, let's talk afterwards, committee members, because, boy, this program hits a home run. And it's not just about 1 year, 2 years. It's how do we keep it going with the support of the organizations to continue an additional 40 years? Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for this bill. You know, one of the things that, you know, as an adult and the you get older and you start working on your budget, you maybe wish you would have paid attention a little bit more in school. And, you know, while I've long advocated that, you know, schools need to have, you know, in high school you need to have financial literacy classes, it's a lot like algebra. You kind of wonder, when in the heck am I ever going to use this? And realizing you probably will need those as an adult. But when you start to actually put those into practice, it makes a lot more sense when you're the one doing the budget instead of having it in facts class and planning out what you might need to have for groceries and stuff. And so I think that's one of the key things that has been so successful about this group, you know, in this program, is really, you know, it's empowering the individuals. And one of the challenges, this last Friday when I was home, I had a meeting with a DHS director in Pine County, and, you know, one of the things we got talking about was, you know, to every one of us, how we grew up with seemed the normal. You know, yeah, we'd been over to our friend's house, we'd, you know, we experienced life in their family, but you know what you grew up in seemed normal, and it was normal because that was what happened every day. It might not be average, but it was normal. And you know, to break out of poverty cycles and things like that, oftentimes we have to break out of normal. And you know, I think that is one of the things that this program is helping to do, is helping to break out of your normal. And you know, and be able to see the success it's had. Yes, there is a financial component that has been important, but I think a big part of that is helping to teach people how to budget. It's empowering people, and being able to empower somebody that really felt beat down and didn't see a path ahead. I mean, I would guess that most of these homeowners never thought that they would be able to afford a house, but yet you have them now investing into an appreciable asset,
That would be the only, you know, and I think the, you know, having it, investing into an automobile, I mean, for the most part, that's an expense. But sometimes you have to expend something to be able to get to work or to be able to improve your, you know, having more dependable car to be able to get you to a job, things like that. And so it is something that I really appreciate the concept behind it and the work that is doing and really giving, empowering individuals. And I, you know, the matching funds, I think, are great. It's helping. And as a Representative Nadeau said, you know, there are other areas that do provide funding as well. But I think it is something that does help really give a goal and help people to realize that goal and to be able to work towards it. So, you know, I do thank you for the bill, and overall I do support it.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a real quick question. It revolves around these matching funds. From my understanding, the state is giving $3, the individual is giving $1. Is there a reason why we've chosen 3-to-1? Because, I mean, if anyone, like a my old employer-based retirement account, if they were going to give me $3 for every one, oh boy, I'd max that sucker out as quick as I could. But at $1.5 million, and understanding that they can receive a maximum of $16,000 total with their own contribution, that means that the state's putting $12,000 into this, assuming they're maxing this out. Okay, that's the assumption. That means that we're only able to, for $1.5 million, we're only able to benefit 125 people. If we go to a 2-to-1 match, then we're looking at 140 people, and if we're looking at a 1-to-1 match, we're looking at 190 people. I'm curious why it's a 3-to-1. I'm not trying to discount the concept that we're really affecting people's lives. The question is, can we affect more people's lives? Because if the state's giving me a 1-to-1 match, I'm banking on that one too. So just a question for why we're doing a 3-to-1.
Mr. Snyder.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. I don't know all the research behind, you know, the 3-to-1 match. I know that research has been done with kind of behavioral economics on the impact of different kinds of incentives. I do know that for somebody who is a working class person making less than 200% of the federal poverty line, they do need a robust match if they're going to actually acquire an asset. The match had been smaller before the last biennium, and the decision was made in the last biennium to raise it up to the maximum of 12, and we still have people that exit the program because they're not able to afford a home, right? Or they switch to a vehicle track. So I think I would argue for that kind of a robust match, because it in my experience, it's what it takes to actually get somebody in today's market for vehicles, for homes. It's a robust match that's required. And so I do think that we see the success that we do because we have a robust match. But I do, I mean, I also wrestle with the question of, you know, there are much smaller programs that reach a much wider, you know, the little baby bonds programs or child savings accounts. And I think all those, that whole range of incentives and programs has a place. But I also think that for really significant, like lasting change, it requires kind of a robust investment. But I really appreciate the question too.
Representative Olson.
Thank you for the follow, the ability to have a follow-up here. So I just, as you were talking, I just saw that it says account holders may save for 2 years. So there's a 2-year limit. Okay, so the concept of an individual at this rate of poverty or whatever the number is, the concept of them being able to take $8,000 on a 1-to-1 match and put $8,000 away, I mean, that's like it's like 30-40% of their annual income just there. Okay, so I'm sorry to throw the question at you and then answer it myself.
I appreciate it.
I appreciate the clarification and the information.
Representative Olson, I knew you would get there as we were talking about it. You're such a smart guy. You always get there. So I knew, like, I watched your mind working while you were sitting there. So I was going to say the same thing. So we're on the same page.
For some people, it just takes a little bit longer.
You're always on it.
It's outrageous. All right. Quick thing to know. Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for presenting this bill. My question was more on
the program's been around for a long time and has outcomes that we've already talked about. I'm just curious, the last biennium, it was said it was historical, you know, funding, but what has been the traditional amount for a biennium, would you say?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. We didn't change a ton with a lot of the funding last year. What we changed last year was really to include more people. So I'll let Dave correct me on this, but last year's bill on our committee was about raising that poverty level a little bit, and then we talked about making sure that, you know, if you were roommates with somebody, because there was a previous restriction on household, so if we lived together both as single moms, independent incomes, then we only one of us could participate in the program. Last year's bill, we made it clear that we could each participate in the program since our finances weren't commingled like that. And so the funding piece of it is to continue at 1.5. And so we're not even asking to increase a ton in that. Now, if you go back a biennium before that, I did increase the funding a little bit then, and I would have to look up the numbers to remember exactly what we increased from, but it wasn't a budget breaker, we'll call it, because we wanted to make sure we were talking about the proof of concept here and how it can do, and so I can definitely pull those bills up, but I think I remember your comments from last year that we love this, right? We still love FAME.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. It's easy to give accolades to this program. I met with the good folks of FAME maybe a month ago, and they're doing great things, great investment. Your survey says that it was 2013. Was the last survey, is that correct?
That's when this one, yeah.
Mr. Snyder.
Oh, sorry.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, and there's some great results here. I would presume that you've taken this information, the percentages, because they're impressive, for the program, and they speak for themselves. They speak louder than our words here, actually, but I would presume that you've taken this survey info and improved the programs as well. Would that be a fair statement?
Mr. Snyder.
Yeah, I guess I'll say two things. One, we've taken the results and incorporated them into how we've evolved the program, and also we are currently doing another evaluation. It's just that at this point we're just around 200 account holders that have gotten in, applied, and started their accounts, but we don't have outcomes yet of, you know, what are the outcomes from this last biennium. So sorry, that may be anticipating part of your next question, but sorry.
Representative McDonald.
Chair, you have great anticipation, because that was exactly was my question, because I can proudly take this survey, I think, although it is outdated, and you answered my question, because you certainly should have been doing or could have done a recent survey, which you are now. I can proudly take this to my community in my Wright County and show them that the investment that we make in the program of your tax dollars, because they are our constituents' tax dollars, and we spend a lot, is worthy. So, yeah, my question or advice would be get that survey done as soon as you can. And hopefully the numbers have gone up, the percentages, because for my very conservative district, very red district, I would be proud to show them this is where some of your money is going. This is why we are giving someone money for their house. I mean, nobody gave me money for a house. I didn't need it. But I can proudly show this and show to my folks who may be skeptical, hey, this is working. This is good. This is what we do in Minnesota to help those who are in need.
Thank you.
So that's all I have to say about that.
I do have a quick question. How many, in the last 2 years, how many account holders are there?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Snyder.
Okay. So we're at just under 200. There was, another follow-up comment, but so when we budgeted out for this most recent biennium, we anticipated that we could help closer to 250 or allocate closer to 250 accounts. However, that was the assumption that was made was that there would be an even spread of folks that were taking, maxing out the match, and some that were just saving, you know, 4,000 or 6,000. As it turned out, many more people maxed out, and so we weren't able to get to 250 accounts. We're closer to around 200 accounts that have been opened with our bank partner.
I think I wish it was more people. I see why you would assume that, but as Representative Olson said, it's like this is 3-to-1 return. You don't see that in real life. That's only in government dollars. That is, I think, maybe the program wouldn't be as effective as 2-to-1, but the main criticism I've heard as I've talked to people about this program, which is generally well-loved, is that the dollar per person helped is a relatively low number. You make up for that with good success rates, unlike many other programs. It would be interesting to see if we can retain those success rates while it scales, because if this is effective, well, again, we have a lot of other programs that are far less effective. Maybe we can make some budget allocations there that have a greater return for everybody involved. But to wrap it up, yeah, I mean, I was basically done. I was going to turn it over to our lovely vice chair. But Chair Katizawatun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sorry I didn't jump on the list. It was one of those situations where maybe everything has been said, but not everyone in the room has talked about it yet. So, Representative Hansen, thank you for bringing this bill forward again. I think that a lot of us really realized in the conversation, the presentation last year, just how impactful this was. And I think the changes that we were able to make to expand the program to more eligibility for people's roommates and those sorts of things is really tremendous. And I think that continue moving in this direction. I also just really wanted to say thank you to Ms. Espitia for being here with us today and for choosing Minnesota to be your home. Your story is really powerful. And I think that really speaks to the way that programs like this are two or more generational impact, right? So the example that you have set for your children by leaving a dangerous situation, coming to a new country, finding your way in a place that, you know, may not have always been as welcoming as it should have been, but returning to school, starting your own business, getting your kids the education that they want and deserve is amazing. And I wanted to thank you again for being here with us and for setting this example.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Hansen to close us out.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, everybody, for the great discussion today and for just helping us remind ourselves and the public and the audience here how important FAME is, that we have to continue to fund it. We know that the return on investment here is significant, and so any amount that we can continue to put towards this matters. And what do we risk if we don't fund it is what I would ask you to consider when we get to that point. I've shared my story when I first started talking about FAME, right? I grew up in poverty. My family taught me how to avoid bill collectors, not resolve things with them. I've lived paycheck to paycheck my entire life, and I still, as a single solo parent, live paycheck to paycheck today. And so programs like this that help empower people to find the tools they need, it's not just because I'm here as a single mom living paycheck to paycheck as an elected official, but it's because of their stories that we've continued to work on these things. And so I couldn't do this without the great folks who are sitting beside me today. I appreciate everyone who's helped me make this bipartisan. Representative Nelson is one of my co-authors here. I invite anybody else to sign on. It's also bipartisan in the Senate. And it has always been a bipartisan bill. So I think investing in folks who need it with good quality, high-quality financial education and ongoing coaching is really what sets this program apart from others. And Representative McDonald, I bet they already have something in Wright County through the Community Action Agency there. And so you may ask them how it's going yourself and maybe able to elicit some just data straight from your community, because Community Action Agencies have been delivering this service for a long time. They're one of the most successful quote-unquote nonprofits in the state with some of the best results and returns on our investment. So anything they can deliver for us, I'm always in big support of that. So thank you, everybody, for doing this. Last thing, Chair West, if you love this program so much, I would love if you'd give me more than $1.5 million. I will take it. And we could do so many more things, you know. So if the question is maybe a separate branch of this as a 2-to-1 match with additional funding, program as is, I'm totally open to us getting creative about how we can make sure we get this into the hands of more people with our great community action agencies and other partners who have done such a phenomenal job rolling this out. I see a lot of them in the audience. I know a lot are watching online. Thank you for finding folks who need this and for continuing to do the work that government can't do right in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. And with that, we'll lay over House File 7076 for possible inclusion in a later omnibus bill. Vice Chair Nelson will now assume the iron-fisted rule.
Okay, the next file on, or item on our agenda is House File 2226, I believe, if we're correct on where we're at. And this will be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Chair West, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move House File 2226 to be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Okay. Well, thank you. We have the bill before us, and Chair West, would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have to say, well, I'll keep it to funny comments. So seeing an array of haichus from this angle, it delights me greatly. So House File 2226. So this one thing that I ran into, so when my child was in an abuse situation in a daycare, and when I went around to providers and say, how can we stop this? How can we stop this? How could you let these people work here? Like, that's something that nobody wants. And all these providers, I got the same response of, well, the background study said they were qualified. And what more can they do? So with that in mind, when you think about people who are taking care of our children, well, a background study obviously is critically important. But with what I've seen, in my, just the last year has been way more abuse than I ever anticipated happening in our state. We heard from one of the families earlier, and there's many more where that came from. It's clearly, they're, clearly we're not where we need to be, because I thought that this kind of abuse was something that only happens in like big cities, New York City or something like that. How could that happen in a tiny place like Minnesota with our 5.7 million residents? But it is here. So we want to address that, and we want to be cognizant that we're not just adding undue burden onto providers, because sure, we could probably track everything, monitor everything, submit everyone to every test under the sun, but that would be harmful to operating what is already an industry that is not doing very well, if we're all being honest. It's ridiculously expensive. Families can't afford it. So how can we address both these things at once? So one thing as a legislator, you're tasked with coming up with bills or just waiting for somebody else to bring you a bill. And I was like, how do I really get through this? And I kept on going through all these things. I talked to a provider who has some daycares in Texas. In Texas, they will tell you way too much about the people you're hiring. I was shocked at what the providers were provided with. Like they would even document like any time somebody is arrested or has any interaction with police, which is something we'd want to know. But like if it's just maybe you went out on a bender and got lost and then peed on a tree, do you really want your employer to know that? That's, you know, that's not what we're after. don't nobody look into that. All right. So I'm glad we can enjoy a rather serious topic. So when people brought this up to me, and my immediate reaction was, oh my goodness, thank God I don't have to figure this out myself. And I feel like it hit the right approach. So what the bill does is, the most simple way to phrase it, if somebody's under investigation for something that is, you know, say like distributing child pornography or something of that degree, if they are currently under investigation, it will be pinged in this system, the NCMEC system. And if they are in that system, when a background study is done by the department, when they're hiring somebody to work with children, it will reference that, and that will factor into the background study that is received by the provider. And there are, this bill is still a work in progress, and we're working with the department and Department of Public Safety and BCA to make sure it does exactly what we hope it to do. But the thing is, you don't necessarily have like a fundamental right to work with children. I think it's totally appropriate to have an exceptionally high standard for who interacts with our children when they're not in our presence. And this bill gives that avenue to the providers to be more discerning, because right now they really can't be any more discerning than what they're given. This gives them that extra level to make sure that the people who are caring for our kids, we have no reason to be concerned. And this actually, for my situation that my daughter experienced, would not have done anything for her, honestly. But when I think about other families in their situations, I believe we could have some help here. And I'm very pleased to have some bipartisan co-authors on this very committee, and my co-chair with Representative Sensenbrenner, Representative Cattizzi-Watoon, and we're committed to working to make sure that this bill can be in the shape it needs to be to do what we're seeking to do and keep our kids safe. So without further ado, I would like to turn over to my testifier here.
Okay. So if you would please introduce yourself for the committee and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. My name is Adrian Lundin Hornung. I'm here today with my wife, Diana. We live in Spring Lake Park with our two daughters. I work at Boston Scientific as a quality assurance engineer, and Diana, who was born and raised in nearby Roseville, is a special education teacher in the Mounds View School District. I am a proud Minnesotan. I am a devoted husband. I'm a hardworking engineer. But above all that, I am a father. My girls are everything to me, and when I meet people and they ask me about myself, the first thing I tell them, the first thing that I label myself as, is a dad. Raising my daughters to be kind humans is my principal goal in life and one of a great source of pride and happiness for me. Even at their young ages, I can already see the compassionate, caring, and intelligent women they are becoming. Unfortunately, I'm also a parent of a victim of child sexual abuse. While attending a daycare center in Minneapolis last year, my daughter became a victim of a heinous crime no parent wants to imagine could ever happen to their child. As a father of two girls, I know the awful statistics around sexual assault against women meant the odds were never in our favor. But it is easy to think that those closest to us will never be one of those numbers, especially at such a young age. I became aware of what happened to my daughter when I was at work one morning last summer and received an email from the daycare center's director. Their message said that one of the employees there had been arrested that morning for possessing child pornography on his computer and phone. I remember reading those words and the immediate physical response that followed. My heart was racing. I felt sick. My thoughts and emotions were all over the place. Receiving that kind of information in the same way that I would have gotten the weekly newsletter was somewhat surreal. I understand it was likely the fastest and most efficient way, but it felt very impersonal and disconnected, obviously. Mm-hmm. At the time, the individual victims had not been identified. We, along with dozens of other parents, spent days in a torturous limbo, wondering if our child had been assaulted by this horrible person. My wife was persistent. She spent those days reaching out to the county attorneys, the BCA investigators, liaisons from any agency that would speak to her, trying to get any information she could. Eventually, she spoke to the lead detective, who was able to tell us the perpetrator's name and that, although they had not confirmed it yet in the images that they had been given, the offender had named our daughter as one of those victims. It was just another awful gut punch. We later went to the BCA headquarters, where we identified our daughter in images by her clothes, her shoes, her hair, the specific bandages on this boo-boo, that owie, that no parent wants to see. She was only 3 years old, barely more than a toddler. I'm speaking here today because I believe it is important that lawmakers understand the extent to which this has impacted my family and many others, as well as the countless families who have been affected by similar events in the past. I'm here today to show support and solidarity to all those other families involved in this situation, to be a vocal advocate for my child and the children of others, to be the face to show you all that this happens to real people, to real children. It has caused lasting harms and trauma. This isn't a broken bone. It doesn't just heal and everything is back to normal. The healing is slow and a constant battle. Nearly a year later, we're still seeing the effects on my daughter and really my whole family. We can see the way this has impacted our daughter in the way she cautiously enters unfamiliar spaces, in the way she's slow to warm to new people, in the words she uses to describe herself when she is upset. She's more reserved and anxious than she used to be. Simple things most parents can take for granted have become much more difficult challenges in our family. It took her months of therapy for us to see the spark emerge more often, to see her true self more than this muted version. This kind of experience ruins your trust in systems that you expect to keep your kids safe. Everywhere we take our children now, we feel like we are on high alert, and we are always questioning the places we go and the people she interacts with. It shakes your faith in the goodness of humans and of society. It is a dark and depressing feeling. It can break your spirit. When my daughter was born, she went into cardiac arrest multiple times. She spent most of her first 2 months of life in the NICU, and with her diagnosis at that time, she was only given a 1 in 3 chance at surviving. It's the kind of thing that can bring a parent to the depths of despair. But while we were at the hospital trying to navigate that terrible situation, we were surrounded by helpers. Our faith in humanity, even in the face of such possible heartbreak, never diminished. Our daughter nearly died there, and still, it didn't break our spirit quite the way this experience has. This event has left my family traumatized and often feeling alone in our suffering. In situations like this, the helpers aren't there to fix pain that our family has endured. However, with your help, we can fix this system to make sure this doesn't happen to other children. When this legislation is passed, it will not take away any of my family's trauma. It will not heal all our wounds. However, we and all parents need to know we can trust caregivers, that when we place our children into the hands of those tasked with caring for this vulnerable population, we can know that they will return to us unharmed. We need to know that the systems that are designed to protect children are doing everything they can to keep them safe and prevent such horrible things from happening. It would be easy for you all to think of my daughter and my family as just part of some statistic, but we are not simply another number. We are real. She is real. She is an amazing child. I ask that you see us, that you hear my daughter's story, and know that you can play a role in preventing this from happening again. I'm asking the committee to support the passage of Bill HF2226. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a very somber and touching testimony, and I'm sorry for what happened with your daughter. And, you know, an apology doesn't seem fair. And that's why we need to make sure that we work on this and make sure that it is right. And I thank you for your story. If you'd like to go to the next testifier, if you would introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Hwang Murphy, and I'm the CEO of People Serving People. So People Serving People is the state's largest family homeless shelter. We serve over 400 people every single night, 70% of which are children. We also run 2 child care centers. We employ 130 staff, all of which have to pass a background check, 40 of which work directly with our children. I'm here today because of Adrian and Diana's courage, because they saw a gap in our system, a place where we don't protect children, that we could. So when I get one of these background checks for one of my staff, I am told by the state that to the best of the state's knowledge, this person should be around children and it's safe for them to work here. But what we found out through digging into this case and working with the 200 parents that were impacted by this is that the state knew about this for 3 years. They knew about it because there is a data system through the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children that sends alerts when they find CSAM, which is child sexual material, to the BCA, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which then in turn shares it with relevant police agencies. We knew about this for 3 years. We had 7 alerts on this offender. He worked at least 3 child care centers, and he was told at minimum of 3 times that it was safe for him to work there. It would be different if we had no knowledge. But we knew. We knew this man was dangerous. And we let him perpetrate again and again. Over 200 children have been harmed or potentially harmed. Or at minimum, parents have to wonder if any misbehavior, any acting out, might be the product of something horrible that is beyond anyone's imagination. I'm here today to tell you that as someone who runs childcare centers, I want to be able to trust this system. I want to be able to trust the background checks. And right now I can't. But through a simple data sharing process where the BCA says, hey, if we've been alerted that someone in our state has had access to this material, is uploading it, that we will share that with the agency that does the background checks, DHS. There are many people that came to you today asking for millions of dollars, asking for a new department, a new agency. We are simply asking that the data that one agency has is shared with another in a very minimal way. Just a yes or no, is this person safe? It really can be that simple. And while we can do nothing to repair all the harm that has happened, you all have the ability right now to make sure that this doesn't happen again, that these men, these horrible folks, then don't work close to children. And so I'm asking you to use the power that you have to then prevent this. Thank you. I stand ready for any questions.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to testify for the committee? Seeing none, let's move to member questions. Representative Sensor Mira.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair West, for bringing this bill. And I'm so sorry for what happened to your daughter. And Adrian and Diane, I'm so sorry for what happened to your daughter. The system failed in many, many ways. I'm familiar with I think the case that you're talking about. I have some dear friends who also sent their children to one of the childcare centers where this individual was. And when I heard about it this summer, you know, started kind of looking into the series of events, and I think saw the same thing that many people saw, which was the system failed multiple times, right? And I agree with you, Chair West. I think we need to have a really high bar for who is working with our kids. You know, I advocate for a high bar and high pay and support to match that, and I think those are the goals of this committee. But in the meantime, I think the bare minimum that we as a committee can do is, like, do no harm to kids, right? And the current system that we have for doing these background studies is clearly not stopping harm that could. I know that we are going to have some ongoing talks with the BCA and DHS. I think there's some concerns around data privacy laws and maybe how that impacts with or intersects with the background studies. And I know that this is going to have a stop in judiciary and public safety, so I think there is time to work out some of those things. But if we have this information and, you know, we have concerns around someone, I think there's absolutely no reason those systems can't talk to each other. So I'm really, really committed to doing the work to get this done. And I think within the jurisdiction of this committee, you know, what we can say is this is a problem and we have, you know, some of the data we need to solve it. And I think we need to keep this bill moving to ensure that we can work on it. And, you know, if we can prevent further kids from being harmed, we don't have any time to wait on it. So thank you so much for coming today. Thank you for sharing your story. I think as legislators, it is our job to never turn away when things are really hard or when really, really bad things happened. And so I'm really committed to doing the hard work on this. And thank you so much.
Representative Liz Zelaznikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair West. It's devastating to hear this. I mean, secondarily, I'm a legislator. First, I'm a mom. Now I'm a grandma, and I cannot imagine the horrificness. And it's more than disappointing. At the end of the day, I'm all for data privacy, but I'm not for protecting criminals at the expense of our kids, period. And whatever it takes to protect our children, our vulnerable adults, it is a minimum bar. It absolutely is astounding to me in the state of Minnesota that this can even happen. And having worked with the frustrations of criminal background studies for several years of my career, to just, I hear what you're saying, and it pains me to hear these things. And I commend you, Chair West, for proceeding with a solution, a true solution, because there's nothing else that we can do except solve this and protect these children and the parents. So on behalf of Minnesota, I apologize to you as parents and to your children to have to endure anything like this. It's unacceptable. It's not the way we do things in Minnesota, and we will find solutions. And I just want to tell you that you're in my prayers, and it's devastating to hear. Thank you.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. I'm also a parent of young kids. So I'm going to try. I have a question that I want to ask, and I'm going to try and get it out. My question, and maybe this is, I think, what Representative Sensenmuro was getting at, is related to the language on line 1.20 through 1.23. I want to make sure I understand what that language says. So the in essence, the language basically refers to that any information that comes back from this background check would not share the reason for the disqualification of this applicant with the license holder or that applicant. I guess my question really is that's a data privacy issue. Is that the reason for that? I'm just kind of curious for what the purpose of that language is.
Chair West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Coulter, for the question. That trying to address the privacy concerns is the reason for that. Seeing how other states do it, they are very much less concerned with that, and I think they're closer to home than we are right now. But the sensitive, you know, it's an investigation or maybe not a full conviction, but it's still kept within state government. It's not distributed privately to anyone else. So say turns out it was all nothing, well, then this is no longer going to restrain this person in any way into the future, but also they're not going to suffer reputational damage that could really go everywhere. I don't know if any of my testifiers have anything to add.
Yeah, the only thing I would add is that it's also to not impede any potential investigation, so that if someone is actively being pursued and followed up with, that they aren't alerted that someone is onto them. It allows the BCA to do its incredible work, our police to do the work that we're asking them to do as well. It allows child care centers to be aware that there is a reason that this person shouldn't be there, or to pause and say that they can't be alone with children while then this investigation continues. We see this as a way that the BCA can continue its work and that the child care center can still protect its children without interfering with one or the other.
Follow up?
Thank you. I was just looking for a little bit of clarification around that language. Thank you. That's very helpful.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, the gentleman to your right, I didn't catch your name, but you said you made a comment that the state knew about this for 2 years. In this particular incident, the state knew this information about this individual?
Yeah, so it's best of my understanding that they were originally notified by the NCMEC system around 2021, and then action didn't happen until, you know, last year.
Representative McDonald.
Could you repeat that again, please? I mean, this is horrible. And our hearts and prayers and work is going to be to hopefully prevent this from ever happening. But can you say that again, how the state knew about this individual and did nothing? Is that what you said?
Mr. Murphy.
Yes, so the state was notified of this, and the lead was not followed up with. And so we're not asking that that the BCA reveal any investigation secrets or techniques that they wouldn't want to be known to the public, but I do think it is fair to say that if you know someone shouldn't be around children, especially at a child care center, that then you let a relevant agency who does the background checks know that. The state knew for 3 years that this was someone that was in possession of CSAM and did not notify any other agency.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Ms.
McCullough. Just quickly, Representative West. So the state, who at the state? I mean, this is criminal right there. I mean, do we know who was notified and who didn't notify the child care center? When you say the state, there must be, that's a complete failure. That is maddening. I mean, who at the state?
Mr. Murphy.
So it's the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is the one that gets the NCMEC tips. They then share it with the corresponding or relevant police agency, but they do not share this data with DHS. And the reason for that is because our current background checks only check if someone has been arrested, charged, or convicted of a crime that is deemed to fit one of the disbarring actions that won't allow you to work near children. However, being in possession or the suspicion of being in possession of child sexual explicit material is not one of those disqualifying bars.
Follow up? Okay. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair West. To the point you're just making on the qualifications, I think the issue is that child care, I assume, is like assisted livings and nursing homes. You're simply notified if they're qualified or unqualified, pass or don't pass. It's that simple. And on any situation, you're never given details of why they're not qualified. You can only tell the applicant that you cannot hire them because they don't pass the background check, and then that individual has to go back and ask for a reconsideration. However, to the point you're making, only arrested, charged, or charged isn't protecting the kids, because to your point, there's known behavior happening that the BCA has. And that interface between agencies is the issue that we have to fix to make sure the children are protected. And I think we can do that and sort through these issues to make sure that that exact thing happens. Thank you.
Chair Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative West, for bringing this bill forward. As you noted before, I'm a co-author. I want to say to the testifier and your family, I'm so sorry that this happened, and apologies ring hollow, and thoughts and prayers can ring hollow, but know that we're going to be taking action on this. I'm so sorry that you had to be the people who have experienced this, that your daughter had to experience this. I also think that in some of these situations, you can vacillate between just devastation and anger and guilt, and I just want you to know that you guys didn't do anything wrong. This isn't something that any of us as parents anticipate. And it, the way that government structures sometimes are set up in silos, the information just doesn't get to the right place. So I appreciate you using your voice to bring this forward and to make sure that we can help prevent this from ever happening again. I don't sit on the public safety committee, so I guess I'm not sure how these alerts work for the BCA, that tip line or something along these lines. It sounds like this information was likely referred to the local law enforcement agency, and then nothing came of it, so he was never charged. I think that we do need to hold people who work with our most vulnerable populations to a higher standard. And I think that that this bill is a step in that right direction. So hopefully we can press a little bit more in the ensuing committee stops, Chair West, and find out what went wrong, if something did go wrong, and if this is just an inadvertent loophole, that we do what we need to do to fill it. So thank you, and thank you again for being here.
Any further questions? Perez Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative West, for bringing some light to this conversation for us to pay attention that we're here for our kids, number one, and for bringing the testimony today that is difficult and challenging. I'm a single mom. I just got an update on how my daughter's reading in her kindergarten class, you know, and you enlist trust in the folks that are with your kids while you're providing for them. And we got a lot of work to do, and it's going to take us to really, really shine the light on a difficult situation of darkness. But I just want to give my love, express my love, because you're here not just fighting for what happened to your daughter, but for all of our kids and for us to get our act together. And I want to see accountability to action and really continue to have these difficult conversations. But if we don't, nothing changes. And the fact that, Juan, people serving people, communicated this. Is that correct? That's a question, Mr. Chair. They communicated this to the state.
It's like, Mr. Murphy.
So the NCMEC system then informed the BCA, yes.
Okay.
Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know what the process is for BCA to communicate that? And maybe I missed that because I was just trying to get my gears going here to understand that this is actually something that had been addressed and nobody did anything, because if it's happened in one center, it's happened in other places.
Mr. Murphy.
You know, I think that's a better question for the BCA.
Representative Perez Vega.
And, you know, in contacting the BCA, because when we talk about our committees, that's going to go to this committee, next committee, you know, as somebody that sits in Capital Investment Committee, I had the BCA give a hearing on a facility and millions of dollars that goes there. And for somebody that is passionate about securing for our children's safety in this committee, and you think about the budgets that there that isn't big, and isn't big as by any means we're talking about that, but they always put a dollar sign to things. And whether it's a facility or the workforce, we got to pay attention to that. We got to hold the accountability into action of saying, I'd rather fund the resources to protect our kids than the infrastructures of departments that are not responding to do their job. I don't have any questions. Thank you.
Anything further? Chair West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my favorite part, honestly, of this committee is we wouldn't have as much opportunity to shine a spotlight and give a voice to families who endure this kind of stuff if this was in the Health and Human Services Committee. We wouldn't have time. We would have to spend another $32 billion to figure this out. That is a great pleasure of this committee that I'm so happy to chair and have the best co-chair at the same time. It's a wonderful experience that we get to give people a voice who didn't normally have it. And so when it happened in my family, it was just like, oh, thank God, I can go, and people actually care if I just start spouting off. And I'm so blessed to have that opportunity, and it is my goal, this, and I know it's a goal the committee shares, is allowing not just that privileged access for us who are, you know, in the media, but for families who endure this, and it gets swept under the rug because it's too expensive to do this, do that. I am thrilled our committee is addressing this, and I'm excited to move this bill forward because it just seems like it's common sense. I think we can work through any kind of nitpicky stuff we got to go through, and I appreciate the committee's support. And I'll renew my motion to refer House File 2226 to the Committee on Judiciary.
All right. Members, thank you for the discussion on this. Chair West, thank you for bringing this bill. It's been a difficult discussion, but something that we've needed to do. And with that, the motion's been made to move to the Judiciary Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion is carried, and the bill is on the way to Judiciary.
So technically, we need the authority of this, both the leaders of each caucus, to go over our 445 time. But what we can do is just go, oh, we lay over these bills, and we can get through the content of the bill. Like, you can go through your presentation. I think the bills are laid over. Nobody read us out. So I'm going to quick just lay them both over presently, but they will be before our committee for our discussion, just so the motions are taken care of before 445, so there's no question. So I will, numbers are there? So, Laura, do you want to move?
There's
okay.
Two of them.
Chair Katisa
Mr. Chair, I would move that House File 1581 be before the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. I would also make that same motion for House File 1158.
All right. The bills are laid over, and we'll just use this time to discuss something that may or may not have been before the committee. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. These are two bills related to the diaper bank. The diaper bank, I was honored to carry their legislation last biennium, and the goal of the diaper bank is to make sure that all of our little ones have dry bottoms, even when their families may not be able to afford diapers. As many of you in this room know, I'm a foster parent, and I don't do babies anymore. But I do sometimes end up on emergency. And so what that means is that sometimes you're in a situation where you have to help out for a short period of time. And diapers and diaper rashes are really, sounds simple, but the truth of the matter is when you can't afford diapers, you let your children sit in diapers that they shouldn't longer than you would like to. And that is because diapers have gone up and crossed by exuberance amounts. They used to be, you know, prior to the COVID pandemic, they were about $16 a pack, and now they're like $22 a pack. And that makes it really hard if your wage before the pandemic was $12 an hour and your wage after is $14, $5 extra, $6 extra for a pack of diapers makes it really hard to keep up. And the diaper bank makes an immediate impact on families. And it helps make sure that we can help all families across the state. So the diaper bank overall has increased, quadrupled, their distribution across the state. In your packets, you have a map that shows all of the places where they have been impactful. And they've increased their services from being able to support about 17,000 children to being able to support about 50,000 children, which I find very impressive. In your packet, you also have their 990 and their annual report, which I think indicates that they are good stewards of the state's money and do as much as humanly possible with the impact that, with the money that they have to impact the most amount of families. So I would, these bills, both of these bills, I know we've laid them over, both of these bills, one appropriates funds and the other makes sure that we continue to give them the funds as they're the only ones who applied. And we have a system now that's statewide that is distributing to local partners throughout the state, and I'd like to keep in that investment going. I would hand over to my testifiers to talk more about the amazing work that they do. Chair.
Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Apologize, time is of the essence. So,
good afternoon, Chair West and committee members. My name is Amy Smith. I'm the advocacy chair for the board of the Diaper Bank of Minnesota. I'm also a community-based social worker and a social work professor.
I want to extend my heartfelt thanks to Representative Hicks for her leadership in making sure babies in our state have access to clean diapers. Thank you as well, Chair West and committee members, for the opportunity to share testimony about diaper need. As a longtime social worker, I've witnessed firsthand the harmful consequences to families when they struggle to afford diapers. It leads to serious physical health risks, including severe diaper rash and infection. It can also impact the mental health of parents who can experience intense stress when they cannot provide such a basic need. In my work, many parents have shared with me their feelings of shame and inadequacy because they couldn't afford diapers for their children. These conversations and the lack of resources I had to offer spurred me to advocate to meet this urgent need. The Diaper Bank is very grateful for the 2023 state allocation of $1.1 million to address diaper need. I'm quite proud of the way our staff, volunteers, and community partners maximized the impact of this investment. As a result, we succeeded, as Representative Hicks mentioned, in nearly quadrupling our distributions across Minnesota from 865,000 to 2.6 million diapers by the end of 2024. The impact of the state's investment is huge. It allowed us to expand our reach from 7 to 74 counties statewide and increased our partnerships, adding 13 new distribution sites. We have been ensuring that the state's generous investment goes further and does more. Despite our expansion, the demand for diapers continues to outpace supply. Recent research shows that one in two families in the U.S. lacks a sufficient supply of diapers. The continued need is evident. For example, over the past 2 years, we had to decline requested partnerships across the state with 76 agencies. Each partnership we are forced to decline represents a missed opportunity to improve the health of Minnesota children and families. Additionally, nearly half of our existing partners report that their current diaper allocation is not sufficient to meet the needs of the families they serve. This is a problem we can fix, but we need additional investment from the state to fix it. That's why we are requesting an increase in state funding to $2.2 million. This investment would allow us to expand our reach to additional organizations through the state and provide a more adequate supply of diapers to our existing partners. The Diaper Bank of Minnesota has demonstrated effective utilization of state funding and can efficiently scale operations to meet demand. We are prepared and equipped for this next phase of expansion to continue to make significant contributions to the health of Minnesotan families. We're ready to act as soon as funding is available. I urge you to join us in eliminating diaper need in Minnesota by supporting HF 1581. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, thank you. My name is Gina San Buenaventura, and I'm a board member of the Way of the Lord Food Shelf in Blaine. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee members and Representative Hicks for the opportunity to share our stories providing diapers to our clients. Way of the Lord Food Shelf is a standalone building in the Way of the Lord campus in Blaine. We serve 180 to 190 families per distribution for distribution day, and we do that twice a month and give out diapers as an added service to our clients. There's now a large increase in the numbers of families we serve who need diapers. For example, in February last year, we averaged 27 families per distribution day, and in March, 32. This year, February average was 43, and March to date is 48. As we are seeing, and we're also seeing an increase in the average number of children per family. So we're seeing more two and three kid families where early on there were mostly one or two children. The $1.1 million Diaper Bank of Minnesota grant in 23 allowed us an increase from our early year's allocation of 10,000 diapers per year to now to 40,000, a fourfold increase. In 23, though, we still ran out of our allocation, and even today, we still look for other sources for which we have to pay. This year, we've been running out of sizes, and it's really hard, at least for me personally, to turn people away or then try to negotiate to offer alternative sizes for them. DBM had no funds in 24 to increase our allocation. We asked for more, but they couldn't do that. For 25. Doubling the $1.1 million funding to $2.2 million moving forward would allow us to serve more families. For example, there was a homeless family who happened to come by, just happened to be driving by, and so we had a food shelf. So they came in,
normally,
and we were able to provide them diapers and food for their babies. And this, we hoped, helped them save money so until they find permanent housing. And when the Ukraine war broke out, more immigrants showed up with their children, joining their friends and families already in Minnesota. Time and again, these folks expressed their gratitude for the diapers, especially for the two families, and my favorites, with triplets and several with twins. A special treat is when they bring their kids over so we can meet who we've helped and see how they've grown, and that always is so much fun for me. So we ask for your support for HF 1581, as the added funding will allow us and our fellow DBM partners to reach more diaper needy families in the state. And thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. Chair Katiza Toon just made a good point. I think we can do a more thorough member discussion on this bill she offered, because it's her day, and I'm tomorrow, if that is good. So thank you for your testimony, but we want to get to that. But go ahead, because their pensions isn't here at 5. So
absolutely. Chairs, can I check and make sure that I can have phone a friend available tomorrow or later this week? Tomorrow?
Representative Hicks, if tomorrow doesn't work, we'll do it on one of my days. We'll figure it out. We just can't. Like, we ran out of time here. So sorry about that. Thanks for coming. Sorry your bill kind of got a little bit of short shift. But we will discuss it later more thoroughly. All right, this committee is adjourned.